From WIPR, I'm Sheila Cast, and this is Maryland Morning. More people in Maryland died of heroin-related overdoses last year than by homicide. We asked State Health Secretary Joshua Sharfstein what's causing the surge and what the state is doing about it. Then, I talk with Baltimore Sun editor and language lover John McIntyre about how word choices shape the immigration debate.
That word immigrant just carries a tremendous amount of emotional baggage. The people who are upset about the number of people in the country illegally, for them, that's a red flag word.
Plus, at one level, trees provide the fibers that bind the essays together in Angela Pelster's new book, Limber. But her conversation with Nathan shows the book is about much more than branches and leaves. First, the news.
I'm producer Matt Purdy. To catch the news, you'll need to listen to us live on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday mornings at 9 o'clock. That's on 88.1 FM in Baltimore and Frederick, 106.9 in Ocean City, and streaming at WYPR.org. Now, on with the podcast.
This is Maryland Morning on 88.1. I'm Sheila Cast. There has been an 88% increase in the number of heroin-related deaths in Maryland since 2011. That's according to a new report from Maryland's Department of Health and Mental Hygiene. What's driving the surge? How can it be stopped? Those are questions that Governor Martin O'Malley and state health officials are trying to answer. And with us now by phone is the state's top health official, Maryland Health Secretary Joshua Sharfstein. Welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me.
And also with me is Derek Hunt, Acting Director of Community Risk Reduction in the Baltimore City Health Department. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
The number of heroin-related deaths had been trending down for the most part from 2007 to 2011, and then it shot up in 2012. Secretary Sharfstein, do you know what's driving the increase?
Well, we know two things. We know that heroin is cheaper and more available than it has been in decades. And we also know that it's increasingly laced with a very potent drug called fentanyl. And we're seeing, I think, a combination of those things in the setting of a lot of people getting addicted to opiate pain medications, just being a deadly combination. We have more people who are addicted to opiates, and then there's heroin, cheap and plentiful, and laced with this very, very dangerous substance.
And the fentanyl, does that show up in most of the deaths?
It shows up in a lot of deaths. It used to be one or two a month from fentanyl, and now we can get 20, almost 30 a month. And this increase in heroin deaths is not just being seen in Maryland. It's being seen up and down the East Coast, and it is just a shocking and very, very dangerous trend.
What do the numbers tell us about who is dying of heroin-related overdoses? Young, old, black, white?
It's pretty diverse. It used to be in Maryland that most of the heroin was concentrated in Baltimore City, and there was a huge focus on expanding access to drug treatment, and in fact, there was a two-thirds reduction in heroin overdoses as treatment expanded. Just a massive success story.
And now, that was about when?
That was by 2009, 2010.
Mm-hmm.
And then what happened, as this surge has happened, it has taken the whole state with it. You see it in Baltimore City, but you see it quite a bit in the county, in Frederick, in the Eastern Shore, Southern Maryland, Western Maryland. It is everywhere, and you also see that the demography has changed a bit. It is generally people in the middle years, not too young, not too old, but of all races, males and females, and across the state.
And do you think that the numbers that you see in the morgue, the numbers of people who die, or the profile of that group reflects the overall profile of users?
I think that it probably is telling us something about the profile of users and how it's changed. I think that we're seeing, just like for a while we were seeing quite a lot of prescription drug use around the state, now that is transitioning over to heroin. And I think that there's something real there. Maryland has some of the best statistics on this problem because all unexplained deaths, the bodies go to one building in Baltimore and the same basic protocol is run on them. So we have the advantage of very good and timely data on overdoses.
Derek Hunt, you train heroin users in Baltimore how to administer naloxone, a drug that can prevent heroin overdoses. The first thing that people you train have to do is recognize
recognize an overdose. Yes.
What are they looking for?
They're looking for see if the person is unconscious, if they're responsive in any way, if there's any change of color in their skin, any forms of shallow breathing or irregular breathing, and if they're saying that, we then train them exactly what steps to take to try to reverse that.
And what are the steps?
Well, the first step would be to rouse and stimulate. The second thing would be to make sure that their airways, if they're not responding, make sure their airways are open. Call 911, start performing rescue breathing, because that's one of the first things to go to breathing, your respiratory.
And this is like CPR?
Correct.
Breathe into their mouth?
Correct. Correct, exactly.
Although now they say you don't have to do that for CPR, that chest compressions
right.
do it.
Right, but with an overdose, you'd want to perform the rescue breathing.
Okay.
And then you want to enter Narcan, the naloxone.
Okay. If you've trained people who are using,
mm-hmm.
and they're the ones having the overdose,
well,
what happened?
When we started this program, what we did was we trained people in couples. So if you had two individuals that actually lived together or they, you know, used together a lot, they would come in couples to be trained. So the law has recently been changed where they're doing friends and families overdose prevention now. So if you had a son, daughter, husband, whatever the case might be in your house that was using, then you could take the training. Therefore, if by chance they was to go into an opiate overdose, then you could bring them out of it.
In fact, if I can jump in, there was a law that was passed in Maryland thanks to the advocacy of parents who lost their children and Senator Klausmeier in Baltimore County. And the law has allowed us to set up programs, and eventually it'll be every county in Maryland. We've already trained more than 1,400 people to be able to give naloxone, so they have naloxone. And it's just as Derek said, it's to family members, people who work in treatment programs, people who live in communities who are interested in being able to basically be a hero. And we have a major statewide outreach campaign to recruit people, teach them the signs that Derek went through, as well as make available naloxone to them.
On 88.1, this is Maryland Morning. I'm Sheila Cass speaking with Maryland's Health Secretary Joshua Sharfstein and with Derek Hunt, Acting Director of Community Risk Reduction in the Baltimore City Health Department. We're talking about the spike in heroin-related deaths in Maryland. The Washington Post quoted Governor O'Malley at a press conference about drug overdoses last week. Quote, "If we want to save more lives, we're going to have to change what we're doing. We're going to have to do more of the things that we know work and do them more broadly," close quote. Secretary Sharfstein, do we know what works?
We do to a pretty good extent. We know that getting people into drug treatment is the most important thing to keep them alive, and it's been proven to extend life and reduce the risk of overdose, and particularly in other parts of the state where they haven't had the intensive treatment resources that Baltimore City has had, that's a very important priority to be able to connect people. And part of our campaign is working closely with 211. So anywhere in the state, people can call 211 and get referred into drug treatment. The other thing that we know works when it comes to homicides is a intense interdisciplinary, interagency focus on data to really understand a particular problem. Homicides are down in Maryland, they're down in the city, and to a certain extent, that is based on an incredible level of coordination. And even though there are far more deaths from overdose than there are from homicide in Maryland, we've never really applied that approach to overdose until recently, until the governor's executive order. And we now are bringing in data from the criminal justice system, from prisons, from the Department of Juvenile Services and the Department of Human Resources, and we're trying to get a picture of where and what the characteristics are of people who are overdosing and use that to be able to intervene when, for example, people have near misses. We want to take advantage of that, just like you might say someone who's shot once might be at high risk of getting shot again in certain areas of the state. Someone who almost dies of an overdose is at pretty high risk of overdosing. And so we're trying to learn a lot of the lessons from the successful work on homicides to apply to this.
I'm a little confused, though, because I hear you talking about how to approach it. We've talked about this before, you and I. It was just about a year ago that you spent an hour with Dan Rodericks talking about this same problem. How is the state's plan to reduce overdose deaths different than last year's?
I think the main thing that's different is the work that we're doing with other agencies on the homicide model, and the fact that we've been able to see some of the things we were planning last year come to fruition. So last year we started planning a statewide outreach campaign. We're now implementing that. Each of the counties last year we started planning to allow them to see all the details of overdoses, much like is done with homicides, where people look at like what exactly happened and can we learn from that case. We now have three teams going on around the state that are actually looking at the details of the overdose deaths in the state. So I think it's a combination of a number of things that we started last year and we're seeing come to fruition, and also the intensity of the statewide response. And, for example, we now have the state police committing to carry naloxone. We have all the local BLS ambulances carrying naloxone. There's just an enormous focus across state, local, government on this problem. It is at this point not something we have under control. I think the governor made that pretty clear. We're getting prepared for additional efforts. As you may know, the Vermont governor dedicated his entire State of the State address to heroin and drug abuse. In New York, Massachusetts, and Connecticut, they're just enormous jumps up, particularly in heroin. And we're part of that, and we need to do everything possible, because right now this is one of the most pressing and growing public health crises we're facing.
I appreciate you talking to us about it. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Joshua Sharfstein is Maryland State Health Secretary. Derek Hunt is Acting Director of Community Risk Reduction in the Baltimore City Health Department. We have more information on our website, wypr.org/Maryland Morning. I'm Sheila Cass. Just ahead, usage of a different sort. Stay with us on 88.1.
I'm producer Matt Purdy. Do you have thoughts on that segment you just heard? Email us at mdmorning@wypr.org or find us on Twitter. We are at Maryland Morning. Now, back to the show.
This is Maryland Morning on 88.1. I'm Sheila Cast. John McIntyre fusses over writers writing as night content manager for the Baltimore Sun. He also writes the blog You Don't Say and occasionally visits us here to discuss how language is used and should be used. Welcome back to the show, John.
Always a pleasure.
Your language space at You Don't Say is not insulated from emotional issues in the news, including the crowds of young Central Americans crossing the U.S. border without papers. A couple weeks ago, you fielded this query, quote, "Your thoughts on the use of immigrant children versus refugee children in Sun articles would be appreciated by this inhabitant of the peanut gallery," close quote. So fill us in on how you responded.
That word immigrant just carries a tremendous amount of emotional baggage. The people who are upset about the number of people in the country illegally, for them, that's a red flag word.
Immigrant is a
immigrant.
Red flag word.
People in the country illegally is the formulation that the Associated Press style book would prefer that we use, because illegal immigrant is one of those words that just touches people off, no matter what the context is or, for that matter, the factual content. But these people are immigrants. It is the word, the single word to describe them. and it's inevitable that we will use it. Refugee is a more problematic word because refugee is at once a common word, someone fleeing a country or a region from some sense of danger, but it's also a legal term. And in immigration law, a refugee is someone whose status is declared as such. And so we can't really refer to these children from Central America as refugees in the paper unless, you know, they have a hearing and they're granted refugee status.
And that is part of what the argument is about.
Some whether don't they, think they should qualify
stay,
for.
And should they stay in the country long enough to have that hearing? So, but your response then, you had to follow up with a post that you headlined, "It turns out I was wrong."
I said that it was improper to call these children criminals because immigration law is civil law, not criminal law. And it turns out I was wrong. There is a distinction. When people overstay their visas, for example, that becomes a matter of civil law, and it's handled through the Immigration and Naturalization Agency. Crossing the border without permission, crossing the border illegally, is in fact a criminal act in the U.S. Code. And so I had to publish a correction and an apology.
And you did.
And I did. That's what we do.
That's John McIntyre, who describes himself as a mild-mannered editor for a great metropolitan newspaper, specifically the Baltimore Sun. We're talking, as we do periodically here on Maryland Morning 88.1, about how Americans use language. And right around the 4th of July, you posted "Let's Be Serious About Language," in which you attacked what you call the peaver vereen, that is, quote, "the complainers about the supposed degradation of English, upholders of bogus schoolroom grammar, and defenders of embattled cultural standards," end quote. You got quite personal. You called the peavers posers, whose snobbery and shallow understanding of the language are readily exposed, close quote. What brought all that on?
Oh, one gets fed up periodically with these people who, the thing about much of the language peeving that you encounter, especially on the internet, is not about really accuracy or precision in the use of the language. It's about language snobbery. I'm one up on you because I know this and you don't, and it turns out that what I know is not really a rule of English grammar or usage at all. It's a superstition.
But does it strike you that you are just as moralistic and intolerant in denouncing those you call peevers as the peevers are in denouncing what they think is a misuse of the language?
Yes, but I'm right.
As they would say, too.
Yeah, but they're wrong. See, I can explain, and I can cite authority, and I can cite usage, I can cite lexicographers and linguists and all kinds of other prescriptivists like me who have exposed these bogus rules and superstitions. So it's not just me saying so out of my preference.
Okay, moving on. You have given us a preview of something our listeners will be able to read on your blog, You Don't Say, later this morning. It's called Totes Adorkable. Before you read it, tell us what inspired you to write it.
Well, one of the things that people complain about is slang. And, you know, they say they think it's sloppy, it's irritating, it's non-standard, and it is all of those things. I got an inquiry about that, and I posted on the blog, look, if there are examples of slang that you dislike, let me know about them, and we'll see if we can't blow them up.
And so you have written Totes Adorkable.
Totes Adorkable.
Take it away.
Many people find slang annoying, and that's as it should be. Thieves have argot, the language in which they conduct their business privately. Professionals have jargon by which they identify qualified colleagues. Teenagers and hipsters have slang to separate those who are in the group from those who are not. So if slang annoys you, it's supposed to. It makes clear that you are an outsider, that you are not with it. But outsiders also have their weapons, and you and I, the hopelessly unhip, can wield slang itself as a counterattack. Attend. Yo, when you conversate with your baby daddies and baby mamas, you can drive hipsters so totes totes cray cray, it's amazeballs. Chillax, bros. You got the verbiage and it's to die for. The beauty part is that you don't have to be accurate and you don't have to be up to date. In fact, it's probably better if you have the words but not the tune. Merely using these words sends a signal as unmistakable as being friended on Facebook by your grandmother. It's over! When we, the stodgy and unhip, use a slang term or expression, that shows that it has crossed over to the wrong people. Our using it hammers another nail in the coffin. So if you don't like it, use it. That'll kill it.
Have you actually tested this theory?
Just now. If the words in that little passage, in that paragraph, sort of vanish after today, then by God, we did it.
We'll see. Thanks for coming in to talk about it.
My pleasure.
Don McIntyre is the night content manager of the Baltimore Sun. He also writes the blog You Don't Say. We have a link to his blog post on our website, wypr.org/Maryland Morning. I'm Sheila Cast. Ahead, Nathan gets limber. Not what you think. Stay with us on 88.1.
I'm producer Matt Purdy. Go to our website to learn more about the segment you just heard, check out our audio archives, or to join in on the conversation yourself. You can also make a pledge to support local programming like Maryland Morning. That's wypr.org/Maryland Morning.
This is Maryland Morning with Sheila Cast here on 88.1. I'm Nathan Sterner. When our show's senior producer, Matt Purdy, handed me a copy of the book Limber by Towson University Assistant Professor Angela Pelster, he told me, this is a book about trees. And that description is true, but only to a point. The essays within this book do tell the stories of specific trees, from the tree that owned itself in Georgia to the loneliest tree on Earth, which once stood in the middle of the Sahara. But the trees are often just a starting point for essays that delve into topics ranging from faith to love, to language itself. Angela Pelster joins me in studio to talk about the book. Ms. Pelster, welcome.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Since trees are the seed from which these essays grow, I want to start by talking about one of the trees in particular, the tree of Teneri, which was considered the most isolated tree on the planet. Tell us about this tree.
Well, it was a tree that grew in Niger in the desert, at the edge of the desert. And, you know, it's hard to date it exactly, but it had been growing for hundreds of years. And it took on a special significance, spiritual significance, to the people of the area who used to take their salt caravans past it, the Tuareg people, and they would stop and pray at the tree before they would begin their journey.
It was the only tree for like 250 miles around.
Yeah.
It was on maps as the tree. You go through the tree.
Yeah. It's really amazing. As my research said, that it was one of the only trees, if not the only tree, that it was on a map. And so it was a really significant tree. And eventually, of course, in the way that these strange things happen, a drunk driver eventually ran into it one night and knocked it over. And that was the end of the tree. And it ended up being picked up and put in a museum instead.
But that was the end of the tree itself. There's something in, about the symbolic power of the tree. Because when the tree disappeared, or rather went to a museum so people could look at it, another tree came up to take the place of the tree that had been there for such a long time.
Yeah. An anonymous person came with a bunch of, I think, mostly automotive parts and constructed a metallic tree that he put in place of it to mark where the tree used to be.
And people still go there to mark where this tree used to be.
Yeah, yeah.
The power of the tree is symbol as some sort of religious thing, perhaps.
I think the way things have been lost in that area, the desert is just, it's like it's its own creature. It keeps taking over more and more of the land. And the rest of the story talks about how, you know, there have been times on the planet when that area, something kind of tilted, and it was a really lush area where all sorts of animals and people lived.
Yeah, Sahara wasn't always a desert.
So in my mind, it sort of marks the way that things are constantly changing and the way we try to hold on to the things that were there, mark them, but also the way we try to adapt to it as well.
And that is one of the many trees in this book, Limber. But the book, as I said, is not just about trees. It's about a lot of other things. And I think a good connection to what you said about how things are constantly changing and twisting is how within the essays themselves, the facts change and twist and correct themselves. At one point, you write that the artist Vermeer had 14 children. Two pages on, you say, no way, he had 15. Were you planning on digressing that way when you started, or did the correct information come in as you were writing?
Well, the whole essay, what I was trying to do was show the process of trying to make meaning and how we make meaning by collecting facts, but also by adapting to things we learn. And that was actually just a really lucky stroke. My editor did an amazing job of fact-checking things for me, because no matter how hard you try, you always miss something. And there were multiple versions of how many children Vermeer had. And when they, she told me that he had a different number of children than I had initially written, at first I changed it. And I thought, no, this is exactly what this essay and actually this entire book is about, is like trying to assimilate, trying to like absorb the different things that happen and how we make meaning of that. So that one was a luck.
On that topic. Your essay Temple, you spend the first several pages on a sexual metaphor with figs, supposedly planted by the Apostle Paul on Cyprus. And then the essay shifts when someone tells you he didn't plant figs, those were olives.
Yeah.
And the essay completely changes in tone, but goes on.
Yeah, that essay drove me crazy. I rewrote it from top to bottom at least four times after that shift, trying to make sense of that. And that really like is me on the page trying to understand what this means, because I was so excited when I found that metaphor. And I was like, this is what I have been looking for.
And it's a beautiful metaphor.
Yeah, I know. I was so upset. But to me, the whole idea of an essay is that you're trying to think through something and you're trying to keep it real and present while you're writing. And so I just rewrote it and rewrote it and rewrote it. And this is what it ended up with. Yeah.
There's another point, a piece that's in part about industrial chemical pollution in Russia, where you refer to a fir tree that was found growing inside someone's lung. There's some dispute whether that actually happened. But I found myself, after looking into it myself, did that really happen? Wondering if it really mattered whether or not it happened. And I think that's part of what the essay is about.
I'm somebody who doesn't care too much about whether or not something happened exactly. But at the same time, that essay is one that really is a great example to talk about, because if it hadn't happened at all, I think that essay would have lost a lot of power. Like, what a strange thing that this hunk of tree was found in a man's lung. And if it was growing, that is an incredible thing. And so, you know, it's one of those moments where I have to stop and say there actually is a lot of power in a thing having actually happened. I can't dismiss it completely the way I want to sometimes, but there's also a lot of power in sort of letting the facts be more fluid and existing in places at the edge of fact, maybe. That essay really, you know, actually pulls me in different directions as well. I'm not sure what to think of it either.
There's also a lot of power in words. throughout your essays. One in particular, Meditations on a Tree Frog, is about language to some degree. I want you to read from the end of it, picking up just after you've explained that the word frog comes from a word meaning hopper, and another word for frog comes from a word meaning to jump. So let's start right after that.
Sure. Some linguists say that the word man is connected to the meaning to think, and that Latin borrows it from mental, mind, and remember. If a frog is a to jump, and we are a to think, then maybe at the heart of man is a brain, and not a heart at all. We have not named ourselves to love, though we do, and guide our lives by it. Scientists say that at best we can hold on to feeling and love for 7 years. That the 7-year itch is really a matter of chemicals, that a brain can only stay drunk on love for a short period of time until it cries out for rest. Because no matter how we begin, one day you will turn to me and hate my crooked front teeth that you once found endearingly imperfect, and I will look at you and find boring your stories that had once seemed so profound. It is inevitable. But at the center of a word is the thing we have forgotten, and the thing it really is. And at the arrival of an exhausted love is the to think itself. A frog jumps, a man thinks, and in thinking is the thing she is. This essay is a love song. In 70 times 7 years, I will not love you at all. Then I will think you until all thinking burns off, until what is left of me is a heart in a maple croaking all night long.
From the essay, Meditations on a Tree Frog, in the book Limber by Angela Pelster, who's joining me here on Maryland Morning with Sheila Cast. I'm Nathan Sterner. It's a book of essays that share the common theme of trees. There was a pair of sentences that are only slightly connected to the essay there included that really stuck with me, where you wrote, "For 7 years, my last name was not my own, but the one I took from a man I loved once. If I do not love him anymore, is his name and the implication of it still mine?" What did that, because that just sort of seemed like it was placed there as kind of a jewel within the rock of that essay. Mm-hmm. How does that, what meaning does that have to you?
Well, that specific instance was, you know, me working through the idea of what is it to have somebody's name. I was married before. The messiness, the legal messiness that happens now of taking someone's name and changing your name afterwards is a really frustrating process to go through. But I also love the idea that, like, words and names hold some sort of magic. And I think we all actually kind of believe that, or else we wouldn't bother to, like, you know, name our children after ourselves for generations. We wouldn't have all these people trying to seek out their ancestry through following a name. So, you know, I think we sometimes forget how much we, like, buy into this idea of sort of these magical or spiritual connections throughout generations. So that was, me just trying to work through the idea of what does this mean to have changed my name? What does it mean to have belonged to one group and changed it?
One of the themes that crops up in many of these essays is faith, is your faith in particular. How does your faith affect your outlook on life and your outlook on the way you wrote these essays?
Well, my faith, like everything I'm writing about in the book, is constantly changing. I'm in a very different place now than I was, you know, 5 years ago, even than when I wrote these essays. So it's always interesting going back and thinking of it in terms of that. But, you know, as much as I have tried in the past to write and really keep my faith out of my writing, but that never works because it's actually very central to who I am, and it's how I understand the world. It's how I translate everything that happens in the world.
And I guess in essays you're explaining that translation to other people, mm-hmm. So how can you do it without?
Yeah. But it's really interesting to try to write in a way that I'm so concerned about trying to be sensitive to the fact that other people don't experience life in the same way I do. And so what I'm really trying to do in these essays is to write in a way that is never trying to explain the world to other people, except that this is me trying to talk about how I understand the world. And so I hope that's what's happening in the essays, is me trying to work through what I believe about the world.
I want to end our conversation with the final essay of your book, and it's a short one, so I'll ask you to read the whole one.
Sure.
It's an essay called Cardinal.
One dark morning after his resurrection, and just before Jesus flew up into heaven, he came to my backyard in the form of a cardinal and balanced on the telephone wire with his skinny black legs. It was early spring, before anything had bloomed, and the grass was gray and mush and rotted. Jesus stood in the sky and whistled the whistle all cardinals do, which sounds something like, "Pretty girl, pretty girl." The sun rose as red as the feathers on his cardinal back and pushed the night off the edge of the world. I saw that it was time for Jesus to return to God, but that he did not want to leave his wire. "Pretty girl, pretty girl, pretty girl," he cried out over the vast and winding earth.
The essay Cardinal from the book Limber by Angela Pelster. This really is an amazing work. Thank you so much for writing it and for joining us here.
Oh, thanks so much for having me.
You can find more about the book online at wypr.org/Marilyn Morning.
Marilyn Morning is an original production of Your Public Radio, WYPR, in Baltimore.
The show is produced by Matt Purdy and Jamila Kay. Nathan Sterner directs and engineers. We have production help from Brandon Block, Alexandra Kennedy, and Justina Latimer.
You can learn more about what you've heard on our show or catch something you've missed on our website, wypr.org/Marilyn Morning.
I'm Tom Hall.
And I'm Sheila Cast. Thanks for listening. See you next time.